What would you do if you lost everything? Everything that you had worked for and nearly everyone that you had loved. Today on Scandia Bible Church podcast, Elder Monty Seemal shows us that it happened to Job. In just a few brief minutes, he lost it all. He lost everything. How does one begin to react to the gravity and the reality of such news? How did Job react? How would you react? And welcome to the Scandia Bible Church podcast for Sunday, April 6th, 2014. We'd like to invite you to visit our website at scandiabiblechurch.org, where you can learn more about us, access past sermons, and can obtain the sermon notes for today's message. And now, let's join Monty Seemal as he delivers part two of his message entitled, A Man Called Job.
Well, good morning. Glad to be with all of you this morning. If you have your copy of God's Word, I invite you to turn with me to the Old Testament book of Job. You can find Job between the books of Esther and Psalms. This is part two of our series through this book. If you missed part one, it is available on our website, and where you can download it, listen to it right there, or download it for your convenience to listen to it later. I encourage you to listen to it if you did miss it, because it does introduce this series and what I'm hoping that God will do with us and in us and through us as we move through this incredible book. As I started the series, I actually tried to get a paper and map out, you know, what text I'd be covering each week, and kind of have, and it doesn't work out that simple. So it's going to be a more of an informal approach, meaning that I'm more concerned with the fact that we walk away with the depth of the material that we have here than that I meet a certain agenda in how we move through that material, because I believe that we will come upon what ought to be life-changing and transforming truth for us. And so while I know the direction that we're going and what I'm hoping to accomplish, certainly no box on how we're going to get there. It's a big book, and how do you eat an elephant? Well, one bite at a time. Now, last time, during the introduction, we read through the first five verses of chapter one, and it gave us a picture of what this man was like. And we're actually going to stay with those same five verses this morning, and then we're going to jump to verse 13 of chapter one and read to the end of the chapter. My goal this morning is that we walk away with a clearer picture of this man, Job, and we really flesh out some of the key components of this man's life and character. And then next week, we'll be going back to verse 6 of chapter 1 and filling in the area that we skipped this week. And I want our thoughts right now to be focused on how Job reacted to calamity. And it may seem strange that, you know, here we are in a book and I'm skipping a section and we're coming back to it. And I hope that doesn't confuse you, but the section that we're skipping tells us things that Job was unaware of. Tells us what's happened in the cosmos, in the heavenly throne room. And Job did not know any of that. And I think to get a full picture of what this man was like, I want to look at him without that narration, without that backstory and backdrop that took place in the heavenly throne room. And then next week we'll come back and we'll study that in detail. In some ways, I want you to relate to Job. And Job, like I said before, he didn't have access to that mysterious conversation that we know about between God and Satan. Job knew none of that. Job was just like us when calamity strikes. He had no warning. He had no foreknowledge of what was going to go on, anything like that. Part of us knowing what took place in behind the scenes may in some way jade us to how Job reacts when he gets this news. We know why the calamity strikes if we read that section. We know exactly what's going on. We know that something bad is going to happen before the bad thing is announced in the story. But for Job, Job was experiencing every temporal blessing that man could experience by the hand of God, everything. And then in a single day, really in just a few minutes, he receives the news that all is lost. It is a lot of terrible news, and it comes incredibly fast. That's exactly how calamity strikes us. I want you to relate to Job in that. We don't know what tomorrow brings. We don't. And we know this. In fact, we can look at the recent mudslide near Oslo, Washington, where nearly a square mile of earth slid down a hillside and wiped out 30 homes, leaving dozens dead. And there was no time to evacuate. It was quick and it was deadly. And then that deadly news is announced to family and the world. And the family receives that news and they get hit with their own calamity as they deal with that and process that. And it came as a thief in the night, didn't it? That's how calamity comes. That's how it came in Oslo, that's how it came to Job, and that's how it will come in our lives, and for some of you, that's how it has come in your life. How does Job react? That's what we want to focus on this morning. We need to have a solid understanding of the nature of this man, and then we can watch his response, and I'll tell you up front, his response is the response of a godly man. Let's take a look at our text. Job chapter 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, and that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now jump over to verse 13. Now on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. When the Sabaeans attacked and took them, they also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. And thus ends a reading of God's holy and inspired word. We ask that he write its eternal truths on our hearts and minds this morning. Now, what we've just read is the beginning to one of the most moving and profound stories known to humanity. It is the account of a righteous man who loses everything and almost everyone that he loves. He lost everything, including his physical health, as we'll see later on in the story. He comes face to face with the sovereign God of the universe, whom he cries out to in the midst of his trials. And so far in this story, we have seen that Job was indeed a godly man who was really unparalleled in his godliness in all the earth. He is described as blameless, upright, fearing God, and shunning evil. Then we see calamity and ruin fall upon Job, this righteous man. And finally, we've seen his reaction. We've witnessed his reaction when that calamity struck. Now, this is how I want you to think about this. Job's reaction to all that had happened completely proves the first thing we learn about Job, and that he was godly and the first in all his generation. This man was the real McCoy. He wasn't fooling people. He wasn't a pretender. And you can meet folks who seem so godly and everything is just neat and tidy in their lives. And, you know, you see them at church every Sunday and you know, at the end of church, they don't blow past that useless stop sign we have here in the corner, and they take their time going up the hill, and they're just steady folk. But you may not have seen that same person when calamity has struck upon their life. You may not have seen them under testing. Now, I've mentioned to you before my fear of heights and my hate for rappelling. Well, I don't really hate rappelling. It's kind of fun while you do it, but you've heard that before. I've mentioned that. You know, and you can sit there and look at this coil of beautiful climber's rope, this Kern mantle rope, and it's, well, it looks strong. And you can tie it to something and pull on it, and it doesn't break, and you can pull yourself up with it, and it doesn't break. But what I want to know is, it's nice that it can hold a bunch of weight, but what happens when that same weight falls from 20 feet or 30 feet or 40 feet and hits the end of the rope? Does it hold then? In other words, don't tell me what you can do with the static weight. Tell me what you can do under the dynamic trial of weight at the end of the rope. You know, when calamity strikes the end of the rope, how will it react then? And so, something can seem strong, but when tested, it proves weak. If you want to know how something measures up, you add stress to it, and then you measure the results. The same can be said of a man. You put a man under stress and calamity, and you quickly see how deep his roots go. Is he a tree that just gives way at the storm? Or when the storm hits and every part of this tree is bent under its stress, it does not give way. Do you see how deep his roots go because he does not break? And so in this story, we see, we get a picture of this beautiful tree, of this man. We're told that he gets hit with this violent storm, but we see that he withstands the storm. It's all very important for us to get as we look at this book. Now, there are two responses that we see in this section. The first is a physical response, and then we see a confessional response or a verbal response. Let's take a look at how this unfolds. This is what we read in verse 20, and we'll read this verse a few times, but it says, "Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshiped." That's the physical response to this news. If we were there observing the man, that's what we would see. And then verse 21, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." That's the verbal or the confessional response. That's what we'd be able to hear if we were there to hear the man. I'm already regretting the tree analogy because some of you are saying, well, if you're not there to hear the tree, does it really make a sound? Stay with me. Now, his reaction here is not only important, it's really phenomenal. We skip verses 6 through 13. We know at this point what Job knows, right? We read this without seeing the trailer to the movie, without reading the reviews. And then we look at verse 21. We see this incredible confession that Job makes. It's the most popular, probably, verse or verses in the book. We all know this confession. We probably could all be able to cite it from memory. But Job didn't have any of this foreknowledge of what was about to happen. If God had come to Job and said, "Listen, my friend, I want to give you a heads up that there's going to be some incredible and terrible things that are about to happen in your life. But Satan has made a challenge that man, and namely you, follow me only because I bless you and I shelter you, but I know that you faithfully trust me in good and even when bad befalls you. So I'm gonna allow Satan to take away everything from you, but I want you to know that I will strengthen you to endure this trial, and your name will be dragged through the mud, but I will vindicate your name. And I'm going to bless you with all the things that you lost, and you will be a great man again. And it's going to get really bad. But I need you to have faith, because in the end, Satan will be defeated. I will prove to everyone that faith overcomes the world. And not only that, but your story of what happened to you would be shared forever and would be an encouragement to many, even thousands of years after you are dead and gone." If Job knew that, and then we read this incredible confession he makes in verse 21, we would assume, well, the guy knew what was coming. You know, he really contemplated it. He took time to write out this wonderful confession, this maxim of his faith that he knew would be passed on for generations, be available to posterity. And what we would be witnessing is another test of the rope under static stress. That's really what we'd be witnessing. But that is not what we have here. We know that Job is a godly man from what we read in verses 1 through 5 of chapter 1. We've already seen the actions that he trusts in the Lord. And that his confession has already been seen really in the sacrifices that he offered from his flocks and herds. But what we see here in verses 20 and 21 absolutely proves what we read in verses 1 through 5 about the man. The weight hits the end of the rope and the rope holds firm. The storm in all its chaos hits the tree and the roots prove deep. Verse 20 shows us that the storm was indeed real, and it did hit without warning. Verse 21 tells us that the roots of this godly man were buried deep in the ground of his faith in God. That's what we see. Look at this honest physical response again. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshiped. Last time I told you the story of Dr. R.C. Sproul Jr., and I mentioned to you that he lost his wife, Denise, right around Christmas time a few years ago, and then just 10 months later, he lost his daughter, Shannon, who was, I think, 15 at the time. And I'm up here, I'm sitting here, I can see all your faces. It's not like we have this huge auditorium where I can't see or that there's theater lights shining on me. And what I saw when I related that story to you was eyes that missed. I saw people tear up. And why does that happen? It happens because we internalize it. We say, "What? That's horrible. What would that have been like in my own life?" And then you picture your family and you picture your kids and you picture those things, and some of you have already witnessed that. Some of you know what it's like to have a series of events that bring bad news and then more bad news. But the rapidity in which Job encounters his loss is astounding. He hears of all of his losses in a few brief minutes. The text tells us that four messengers came. Messenger two started relaying the news as messenger one was finishing. Messenger three starts relaying news when messenger two is finishing, and so forth. It wasn't a rain. This was a complete flood that hit. Each person is not only the bearer of bad news, but he bears worse news than the previous guy. If the worst news is mentioned first, then nothing else matters. The rest of the news doesn't matter in light of the first one. You know, if somebody said your child has died and then tells you your house has burned down, both bad news. The second one is inconsequential to what just took place. But cruelly for Job, the news gets increasingly bad and ultimately culminates in a messenger revealing to Job that not one or two, but all 10 of his children are dead. That's real. I want you to, so here's his real reaction. Verse 20. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshiped. Some of that is a cultural response. We know that. In our day, we probably wouldn't shave our head or tear our clothes, but it's an expression of a tormented soul within his cultural context. I told you last time that studying through Job often heightens one's sense of calamity and pain in our own lives. And I absolutely believe that God will use this study to prepare us for such a time, knowing that our lives are really never far from pain. Every day, there is suffering mixed with our joys. That is a fact. There is not a day in your life that is not mixed with suffering. I remember one of the happiest days of my life, my wedding day. Of course, one of the most memorable and joyful days. But I also remember my new bride suffering from strep throat. I remember her having to forego a song that she had planned to sing. There has never been a day when we are without struggle of some sort. The sad thing is that we have, in many ways, just become numb to it. Why? Because we're used to it. I remember a few years ago, I had a 1967 International pickup. I love that truck. It didn't work as designed. It didn't work as it rolled off the showroom floor. For starters, it no longer sported the 345 cubic inch V8, but now it had a 500 cubic inch Cadillac engine because gas is so cheap, why not? But one distinctive trait I remember is that the steering wheel had considerable play in it. I became so used to the play in the steering wheel that I automatically adjusted for it and I never gave it a second thought. But I remember my brother-in-law, David, borrowing the truck to to take water over to some cattle when I was on vacation, and he couldn't get over the excessive play in the steering wheel. And while I loved my International, David named her the Widowmaker. And he said that driving the truck was close to just committing suicide. And I thought, when I received the news, I thought, well, you know, perhaps something broke while I was gone. I mean, something obviously deteriorated significantly. But then when I drove her, I couldn't figure out what all the fuss was about. And you see, even when not running as designed, I was used to it. It no longer bothered me. There are some of you who have ailments and pains that you simply live with. They're part of your everyday life, and the doctors have promised that there's no hope. It's not like there's a light at the end of the tunnel for you. If someone asks you how you're doing that day, you know, your day is doing great as long as the pain isn't so bad. As long as whatever the new medication is that they've given you is holding it off, and it's allowing you to function. Of course, you're not able to do the things that you want to do, because the pain is restrictive, but that restriction has become normal to you. The whole while we are in pain, we know that it's not supposed to be that way. Even when it becomes normal to us, we know it's not right. It's not supposed to be this way. Listen, this is going to come as a shock to you when I say it, because it's become so normal to us. Listen, I want you to think back to that international that was not like it was when it rolled off the showroom floor. Death, listen closely, death is not a normal part of life. Neither is sickness, neither is pain. Those are part of the fall. They are the consequences of sin. There's nothing normal about death, but we've accepted it as normal because it will happen. As will sickness, as will pain. They are normative in light of living in a fallen world. But how it ought to be does not have death in the picture. Not as designed. I remember going to many open casket funerals as a child. It's the way we had funerals. And I had older family members. A lot of them died. And I remember watching the whole line of people as they would come up and for the viewing. And, you know, some people would be crying. I remember a few people that would kiss the forehead of the body of the deceased. And I always found that fascinating as a child. But when I walked up, I never, you know, could build up the courage or nerve to do that. I saw a man who, he was the husband of my cousin, and I could ask him questions as a kid or whatever, and I saw him kiss the head of my grandfather. And I asked him, I said, what's it like touching a dead body? And I remember his response. His response has come back to me and meant more to me. He's not a Christian or anything, but it's been meant more to me now that I've looked at Job and I've thought about these things. And I remember he said to me, It doesn't feel right. It feels unnaturally cold. And then I remember this. He says, it feels wrong. Of course it felt wrong, because it isn't as designed. But because tragedy strikes, Job must have felt how incredibly wrong it felt in his life when calamity struck him, because it struck everywhere. His entire business and sustenance was destroyed, all of his wealth, and while he was getting over that, all of his dependents, starting with his servants, and were put to the sword, and finally his children tragically killed. He falls to the ground, tears his robe, shaves his head, and he lays there in the midst of dust and ashes. This man is in real pain. But in his pain, in his physical reaction as he collapses to the ground, he makes a theologically robust statement that we see in verse 21, where we read, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." If all we had from this story was the reaction in verse 21, we might really question how sincere this guy really was. I mean, is he even human to say that? But verse 20 lets us see that his strength was at its end. Let me quickly point out some remarkable things here that we see in his reaction. The first is that at the end of verse 20, if you notice, it says that he worshiped. Now, that in itself is not man's usual first reaction to a situation like this. You don't usually tell a guy the worst news ever and have him spontaneously start worshiping God in that situation. Okay? But that was Job's reaction, and the reason it was Job's reaction was not because it's a normal reaction to men in the situation, but because in Job's life, it had become a practiced response. It was his habit. It was the way, listen, he always reacted. We see that in the first five verses. After his kids would gather for a party, his normal reaction was to worship God and offer sacrifices just in case they sinned against God in their hearts. And if you look at the end of verse 5, go back there and look at it. This is what it says, doesn't it? Thus Job did sometimes. It doesn't say that. Thus Job did whenever his multi-billion-dollar business wasn't too much work for him and he had the time to do those kinds of things. Doesn't say that. It says, thus Job did continually. Listen, Job could not have reacted the way he did unless he had disciplined himself to react to life's trials in that way. He had learned to become dependent upon God in all things. And this theological statement that he makes in verse 21 says to us that when Job was found wanting, he found God faithful and he trusted in him. Not only does the text say that Job worshiped, but notice that it says that at the end of verse 20. In other words, it's not just saying that Job's confession alone was a sign of worship or worship, but it's saying that his reaction, his expression of grief, was in itself an act of worship. Now listen, if that sounds confusing to you, I want you to know that your grief, when you grieve over things like this, reflects God's grief. In other words, God grieves over death and actually hates death more than we do when we experience it. God grieves over the consequences of sin that brought death, that brought sickness into this fallen world. Romans 8 says this. It says, the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. This groaning that is within our spirit is that things are not as they should be. Things are broken, and we are crying out for them to get fixed. That's what the creation is doing. All the things that tear us apart at the seams are the things that the gospel announces that Christ has overcome. Death is the final enemy, but make no mistake, it is an enemy. And grieving, as it moves you closer to God, is worship, even when grieving involves nothing but silence or when it involves nothing but weeping. In our grief, we acknowledge that what just happened to us is not right and needs to be fixed. It is our groaning in the spirit that we live in a fallen and a broken world. Listen, this is not something that's peculiar only to the Christian. Even the atheist acknowledges this, even though it doesn't make sense in their worldview. To the atheist, of course, you're just an accident, just a bunch of random molecules and cells, and there's really no reason, when you think about it, for an emotion such as love, for an emotion such as grief, as the only emotion that would make sense is one that's necessary for survival. When an atheist cries at the loss of a wife or child, it's an admission that what has taken place isn't right. The strange thing is that according to the atheist worldview, why wouldn't it be? Death would be natural to that worldview. After all, survival of the fittest culminates with the idea that death is really ultimately good, meaning beneficial. It's beneficial. It's the betterment of the species as weakness is culled out of the gene pool, right? But even as I say that, you and I would never say those words to an unbeliever who is grieving because their suffering is real. And even while they have rejected God, their suffering is real. And even why they can't make sense of why they suffer and their worldview can't make sense of things like food that tastes good or a sunset that's beautiful, it's real suffering. And when God created the world, he pronounced it good. But it was man and his sin and rebellion that brought devastation to the world and brought the curse to creation. It's now a fallen world. Nothing is truly good any longer. But Christ came to fix all that had been broken and to redeem all that is fallen. In other words, he came to make things right. You think back to those of you that have read or Narnia or seen the movies. You think back to Narnia and the White Witch, and the whole ground is covered in snow and frost, and what do they go around the Narnia and say? Well, it's so cold here. It's always winter, but it's never what? It's never Christmas. Always winter, never Christmas. And then the rumors start coming, and well, Aslan is on the move. And what happens? Things start to thaw. Why? Because he's come to make it right again. That's what Christ has come to do. Now, the next thing I want you to see in Job's reaction is this, is that his expression of grief, physical and everything else, is not condemned. This is what we see in verse 22. Through all this, all that had taken place, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. And I think that we live with the idea that we're not spiritual if we grieve. Ever get that idea from Christians? You know, it's as if we need to be stoic in our Christianity. Listen, there's nothing stoic about Christianity. Christianity means that those are followers of Christ, and there was nothing stoic about Christ. We saw him grieve even over Jerusalem. We saw him grieve at Lazarus' death, and we saw many reactions that would surely show that he's not stoic. But there are these two opposite extremes. Extremes are usually wrong, right? And we have these two opposite extremes. The first teaches Stoicism, teaches that Christians are supposed to be almost monkish in their reaction to anything that befalls us in this world. And the second extreme is that Christians are always happy-clappy in their reaction to what has befallen in the world. That's the two extremes. And both of those extremes teach something faulty about Christianity. You know, you open up a modern course book and you look at it and you tell me if you think it reads like the Psalms do in the full range of human emotion. It doesn't. In fact, even songs that borrow verses directly from the Psalms only borrow verses that are joyful and happy, not the other way around. They forego the verses that deal with real pain and turmoil. That's a fact. But listen, the Psalms is actually the worship book of the church, isn't it? It's actually God breathed for all ages, and as we read it, that means that we can trust it, and we surely know that everything we read is actually praise-worthy material when we read it. It's the Psalms. It's, guess what? It's in the Bible. Psalm 13. How long shall I take counsel in my soul? Having sorrow in my heart all the day, how long will my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Enlighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. That verse is never going to make your course book. But the following verse states, I have trusted in thy loving kindness. My heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. That will make it. Same psalm. In the psalm, one thought flows into the second thought. They're meant to be read and sung together. It was the worshiping person who is crying out in his grief, and he finds good news and hope from the God who is his salvation. What about Psalm 31? Maybe this will be the next hit on Christian radio. If we can figure out a tune, you can clap along if you want. Goes like this. Here's the lyrics. For my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength has failed because of my iniquity, and my body has wasted away because of my adversaries. I've become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I am forgotten as a dead man out of mind. I'm like a broken vessel, for I have heard the slander of many. terror is on every side. While they took counsel together against me, they schemed to take away my life. And let's repeat the chorus. It's not going to happen. How about this catchy tune from Psalm 38? For I am ready to fall, and my sorrow is continually before me. For I confess my iniquity. I am full of anxiety because of my sin. But my enemies are vigorous and strong, and many are those who hate me wrongfully, and those who repay evil for good. They oppose me because I follow what is good. Do not forsake me, O Lord, my God. Do not be far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord, my salvation. You get the point. We have bought into a lie, and the lie is that Christianity is either supposed to be stoic or happy. I'm not talking about joy in the face of trials. I'm talking about a fake and phony reaction and feeling that nobody believes because it's not real. It seems that you can't even grieve and mourn at a Christian funeral. In fact, I want to further say this. It seems that Christians no longer have funerals. You might be allowed in some circles to have a memorial service. Well, let's change the name of that and we'll just call it a celebration of life. Job was not lying on the ground celebrating the life of his children. He was lying on the ground crying at the death of his children. They died. It was real. He was in pain and he worshiped God in his pain, and God did not condemn him. God said he did not sin in all that he did. 1 Thessalonians 4:13 tells us that we do not grieve as the others who have no hope, but that does not mean that we do not grieve at all. What it means is that there is hope that is upholding us even in our grief, and that the sting of death has been taken away by the cross of Christ. That's what that means. Death is still an enemy, and believe me when I tell you, it still hurts. What we see here is that our real grief is not condemned in any way. Every other world religion attempts to mask pain, circumvent pain, minimize pain, ignore pain. Christianity alone deals with it openly. And more than that, we worship a God who suffered in the person of Christ. There's no truer description of Jesus than that of the suffering servant. Let me conclude this morning by giving you three important truths that we need to know about Job as we move forward in this series. The first is that Job occupied a unique role in redemptive history. We honestly know very little about Job apart from what we read in the book that bears his name. He is mentioned elsewhere in Scripture. We talked about this last time. It's an ancient book. He lived a long time ago during the time of Abraham, which means that he had very little revelation about God in comparison to what we have today. He also had little information about the coming Redeemer in the Garden of Eden. In Genesis chapter 3, God announces the defeat of the serpent, and he says that he's going to restore all that's lost, and in order to accomplish this, he's going to send a redeemer who is going to be a sufferer. And we know he's going to be a sufferer because the text describes in this prophetic first glimpse of a redeemer in Genesis 3 that he bruises his heel, crushing the serpent's head. Job believes God. He offers burnt sacrifices and offerings to God, both for his own sin and for the sin of his family, and the Lord delights in the person of Job. It was God himself who brought Job to the attention of Satan, and we'll look at that next week. That's a unique situation in itself. We will no longer ever suffer in that way, ever. And you might have heard it preached differently. I'm telling you that's a fact. Because since the cross of Christ, Satan, listen, no longer has access to the heavenly throne room. Nor will God entertain any accusations from him against his people. And that we can clearly see that in Revelation 12, and maybe as we move forward, we'll have time to take a look at that. God himself describes Job as unique in all the world. We not only see that in his piety, but in the singular nature of Job's trial. There's a reason why we're still telling this 4,000 years later. It's because there hasn't been a better story. This is it. Yes, we've all tasted it, not like this man. We may not understand what God did or why he did it, but we will attest to the fact that the secret things belong to the Lord. And we know that God will always do right, even when his reasons are hidden and unknown to us here in this life, although they will be revealed to us in heaven. The second thing that I want us to remember as we move forward is that even Job, who is described as upright and blameless, and we've been emphasizing his righteousness, is not without sin. He offers sacrifices for his own sin. He was born in sin. He eventually tasted death. And this description that we see of the book of Job is a description that focuses on the spirit of the man, not necessarily the flesh of the man. Job was everything that a sinful but redeemed man can expect to be, meaning that his trust was in a redeemer. He looked forward to a redeemer. We look back to a redeemer whose name is Christ or Jesus. From the story, it would probably be safe to say that the only one in all of history who excelled Job in both innocence and in grief was Jesus himself. Jesus, who sinned not at all and who suffered and died for the sins of others, for his people. And that will bring us to our last thing that I want you to take away, and that is that in many ways, Job is a type of Christ. In many ways, we see this throughout the story. As Job suffered, so did Christ suffer. Job would eventually be vindicated, so was Christ eventually vindicated. Job, at the end of the story, will intercede for his friends. Christ intercedes for his church. But in every way that we see Christ foreshadowed in the life of Job, the reality and light of Christ is far greater, where it pales in comparison. It was Jesus and not Job who fulfilled all the righteousness and fulfilled all the requirements of the law, which is something that Job couldn't even accomplish for himself, let alone others. In every way that Job is an example to Christ, Christ is the greater example. In every way in which we look at Job's life and we see his piety and we see his righteousness, and it's appealing to us. It's only appealing to us because it is Christ-like. And therefore, God has given us the desire to be like that, because that's God's goal for us. That's part of what he's sanctifying us to be and what he's already declared us to be. It's his mission. Perhaps the greatest example that we can learn from this man is that while suffering beyond all human comprehension, he declares, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end he will stand upon the earth." How much more should those words ring true for us who have God's completed revelation to man as we stand on this side of Calvary? As we look to Job in the midst of our suffering, the danger is that we see in him the perfect example for us to follow. Job's not the hero here. Christ is the hero. Job's hero, if you were to ask the Job, who would your hero be? He says, a mediator. Give me a mediator. I need a redeemer. Job never looked at himself as a hero. He's not the hero. If you want to follow Job as an example, you look to Job, and you follow the gaze of his eyes, because he's looking towards Calvary. He's looking towards the cross. That's what we get out of this. Follow the direction of his gaze as he looks to Christ. Let's pray. God of grace, you have indeed come in our difficulties, in our necessities, in our distresses that we have in this life. These things that for us are ordinary concerns of life, because we live in a fallen world We're a broken people. We are so in need of counsel, of defense, of comfort. Help us to look to our Redeemer and Mediator who represents us before you. Let us reflect him upon the earth. Let us look to Christ to plead our cause as we show forth his praise. Lord, while we sorrow, you have been and will continue to be the help for your people. You have led us and we have found your promises to be true in all ways. In our sorrow, you have been our help. In our fear, you have been our deliverance. In our despair, you have indeed lifted us up. Help us to look to you, even when we are surrounded by mystery and are confused by our circumstances, knowing that you know all things and you're sovereign over all things. Let our faith be in your goodness, even while we may not have answers. Grant us this, we ask in Christ's name and for your kingdom's sake. Amen.
Well, that wraps up our sermon for this week. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line through our contact page on scandiabiblechurch.org and let us know where you're listening from and how our church family can pray for you. Scandia Bible Church is located in the beautiful Northwest in Paulsboro, Washington. If you ever find yourself in our area, we'd love to meet you. So until next week, for all of us here at Scandia Bible Church, may God richly bless you.